Amen. Amen. Okay, very good. We're going to pick up with Naso. We had a bit of a break last Shabbat because it was the Shabbat of Shavuot. So now we are continuing our study in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, with chapters 4 through 7. This portion is called Naso, which means take. And Sachs's summary begins this way: continuing the preparations for the Israelites' journey from Sinai to the Holy Land, Parashat Naso contains a melange, a blend of subjects whose interconnection is not immediately obvious. The roles of two of the Levitical clans, Gershon and Merari, the census of the Levites as a group, rules about the purity of the camp, the law of the sota, the woman suspected of adultery, the Nazarite, and the priestly blessings. The parasha concludes with a lengthy and repetitive account of the offerings brought by the tribes at the dedication of the tabernacle. The first of the following essays is about the nature of a census in Jewish law and thought. The second looks at a striking feature of the book of Numbers as a whole, its emphasis on the tribes as distinct entities. Why does the Torah focus on this internal division within the nation rather than focusing on the nation as a unified whole? This, by the way, is something we have talked about in past studies. The third explores attitudes within the tradition to the Nazarite, or of the Nazarite, the individual who voluntarily accepted a higher than usual standard of personal holiness. The vow that the Nazarite takes is interesting. It isn't explained in great detail in the text. There is a chapter on the Nazarite vow, but some of the aspects, some of what the Nazarite is required to do, are different than are required for the taking of other kinds of vows. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. At any rate, the fourth is about the priestly blessings, one of Judaism's oldest liturgies. This is a blessing you are certainly familiar with. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you. You're familiar with that passage. That's in the book of Numbers in this portion. The fifth advances a theory about the underlying logic of the various aspects of the parasha as a whole. So we're going to read a passage called Pursuing Peace, or an essay called Pursuing Peace. And it begins, what is the logic of Parashat Naso? It seems, on the face of it, to be a heterogeneous, that is, diverse in character or content, collection of utterly unrelated items. First, there is the account of the Levitical families of Gershon and Merari and their tasks in carrying part of the tabernacle when the Israelites journeyed. Then, after two brief laws about removing unclean people from the camp and about restitution, there comes the strange ordeal of the sota, the woman suspected by her husband of adultery. Next comes the law of the Nazarite, who, as we saw earlier, voluntarily, and usually for a fixed period of time, took upon himself a special holiness, special holiness restrictions, among them the renunciation of wine and grape products, haircuts, and defilement by contact with a dead body. By the way, this is not the result of a Nazarite vow. It's just because I like long hair. Okay? Moving forward, this is followed, again seemingly with no connection, by one of the oldest prayers in the world, still in continuous use, the priestly blessings. Then, with an almost inexplicable repetitiousness, comes the account of the gifts brought by the princes of each tribe at the dedication of the tabernacle, a series of long paragraphs repeated no less than 12 times, despite the fact that each prince brought an identical offering, right? So these offerings are delineated 12 times, and the wording of these offerings is identical. So the same section is repeated 12 different times, word for word, except for the name of the tribal leader who brings it. And as I mentioned, this is something we've discussed in previous studies. At any rate, why does the Torah spend so much time describing an event that could have been stated far more briefly by naming the princes and then simply telling us generically that each brought a silver dish, a silver basin, and so on? The rabbis made the assumption that every word of the Torah is meaningful. It tells us something we need to know and does so in the fewest possible words. So the repetitiousness of this particular passage cries out for explanation. The question that overshadows all others, though, is what is the logic of this apparently disconnected series of laws? The answer we will find time and again in Numbers, more than in any other book of the Torah, lies in the close connection between law and narrative. Between law and narrative. Law in Judaism is not random. It's not arbitrary. It is not there simply because God wills it. The Torah wants us to understand why the law is as it is. And it does so by telling a story. A story about events in the past that did not turn out as they should have, and to which law is the antidote, the remedy, the tikkun, the repair. So it is here. In the previous essay, we spoke about the priestly blessing with their concluding line, "The Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace." It is no accident that the concluding word of this highly structured blessing is shalom, translated here as peace. However, the translation, and I'm sure this will not surprise you, is not very precise. In English, peace means the absence of war, freedom from disturbance, calm, tranquility, restfulness, and the like. In Hebrew, shalom means more than that. In the long analysis, the 15th century Spanish Jewish commentator Rabbi Isaac Arama explains that shalom does not merely mean the absence of strife. It means completeness, perfection, the harmonious working of a complex system, integrated diversity, a state in which everything in its proper place and all is at one with the physical and ethical laws governing the universe. Peace is the thread of grace issuing from God. May he be exalted, stringing together all beings, supernal, spiritual, intermediate, and lower. It underlies and sustains the reality and unique existence of each. Similarly, Isaac Abravanel writes, "That is why God is called peace, because it is he who binds the world together and orders all things according to their particular character and posture. For when things are in their proper order, peace will reign." And this is a commentary to the tractate in the Mishnah, Pirkei Avot. This is a concept of peace heavily dependent on the vision of Genesis 1, in which God brings order out of tohu vavohu, out of chaos, creating a world in which each object and life form has its place. Peace exists where each element in the system is valued as a vital part of the system as a whole, and where there is no discord between them. By the way, you can see how we use the word peace in English, for example, when we talk about a peaceful demonstration regarding the injustices that take place in our society. But a peaceful demonstration is a demonstration that does not result in violence, right? But from a Hebrew perspective, we will only experience peace if you look in the words of this last section. We will only experience peace when we see the chaos that characterizes our culture resolved, right? When we finally see or experience a time, right, peace exists where each element in the system is valued. And in the case of what is currently taking place in our culture, where we see black lives valued. But of course, we need to appreciate the diversity that exists in our culture and treasure each and every element. Everybody has to be treated in the same way, with fairness, with compassion, with justice. And frankly, that's the kind of peace we aspire to, right? Where it doesn't matter. Well, like Martin Luther King said, you know, people should not be judged by the color of the skin, but by the content of their character, right? That's what we want to see. But that's what distinguishes peace in Hebrew from peace in English. At any rate, in this vein, the 19th century commentator Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch explained the conclusion of the story of creation in Genesis 1. Six times God sees what he has made and pronounces it good. On the seventh occasion, we read, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. What is the difference between good and very good? Good, said Hirsch, means good in itself. Very good in its totality. It is a reference to the harmony of the universe, despite its complexity. And this idea, of course, runs through the gamut of what the Hebrew concept of peace connotes or expresses. What is the theological background to the biblical concept of shalom? Whereas the ancient myths of all other cultures saw reality in terms of the clash of primal forces, Judaism saw God as the unity that creates diversity. Shalom is the harmonious coexistence of otherwise conflicting individuals, tribes, and nations, each with their distinctive nature and unique contribution to the totality of humankind. Shalom is thus not uniformity, but in integrated diversity. Peace is not uniformity, but integrated diversity. The philosopher Joseph Albo saw conflict at the heart of physical, metaphysical existence. Everything that exists is a composite of different elements, each of which seeks to overcome the others. Thus, the need to establish peace is a constant requirement of physical being. And of course, this is an incredibly important idea, right? That peace must be pursued, right? Must be tended to. It's obviously not enough to assume because a violent act isn't taking place at the moment that we are experiencing peace, because we won't experience peace until these conflict issues are resolved. He writes, each opposing element seeks to overcome and vanquish the other, and once it has overcome the other, it will not rest until it has absolutely destroyed it and wiped it out of existence, and the composite object will thus cease to exist. Conciliation between these two opposing elements is called peace, conciliation. And on its account, being is sustained, and the composite entity can continue to exist. The various provisions of Parashat Naso are all about bringing peace where there is actually or potential conflict within families or communities. The most obvious case is that of the sota, the woman suspected by her husband of adultery, a situation fraught with danger of violence and abuse. What struck the sages most forcibly about the ritual of the sota is the fact that it involved obliterating the name of God, something strictly forbidden under the circumstances. The officiating priest recited a curse, including God's name, wrote it on a parchment scroll, and then dissolved the writing into a specifically prepared water. The sages inferred from this that God was willing to renounce his own honor, allowing his name to be effaced in order to make peace between husband and wife. By clearing an innocent woman from suspicion, though the ordeal was eventually abolished by Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai after the destruction of the Second Temple, the law served as a reminder as to how important domestic peace is in the Jewish scale of values. This next paragraph talks about how important God's name is and how important is writing in which God's name has been inscribed and what we do with it as a result. But I'm going to skip over this for the sake of time and keep reading from the essay. The passage relating to the Levitical families of Gershon and Merari signals that they were given a role of honor in transporting items of the tabernacle during the people's journeys through the wilderness. Evidently, they were satisfied with this honor, unlike the family of Kahat, detailed at the end of the previous portion, one of whose number, Korach, eventually instigated a rebellion against Moses and Aaron. Likewise, the long account of the offerings of the princes of the 12 tribes is a dramatic way of indicating that each was considered important enough to merit its own passage in the Torah. People will do destructive things if they feel slighted and not given their due role and recognition. Again, the case of Korach and his allies is proof of this. By giving the Levitical families and the princes of the tribes their share of honor and attention, the Torah is telling us how important it is to preserve the honor of the nation by honoring all. The case of the Nazarite is in some ways the most interesting. There is an internal conflict within Judaism. On the one hand, there is a strong emphasis on the equal dignity of everyone in the eyes of God. On the other, there exists a religious elite in the form of the tribe of Levi in general and the Kohanim, the priests in particular. It seems that the law of the Nazarite was a way of opening up the possibility to non-priests of a special sanctity close to, though not precisely identical with, that of the priests themselves. This too is a way of avoiding the damaging resentments that can occur when people find themselves excluded by birth from certain forms of status within the community. I wanted to talk about the Nazarite, so I have the passage here. I'm not going to read all of it. I just want to read some highlights and then talk about the vow that Paul takes in the book of Acts and see if there are are similarities between them, because the vow itself is incredibly important. This passage in Numbers chapter 6 begins in verse 1 by saying, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or a woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of dedication to the Lord as a Nazirite, they must abstain from wine and other fermented drink." Why that is a provision connected to the Nazirite vow is not explained, but they cannot drink grape juice, they cannot eat raisins, they cannot eat anything, grape leaves, anything associated with the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins of the grapes themselves. During the entire period of the Nazirite vow, no razor may come upon their head. They must let their hair grow long. And obviously, depending upon how long the vow lasts, right, it's possible for the hair to grow a little bit or a lot. Throughout the period of their dedication, they are not allowed to come into contact with the dead, just like in the case of the priest. If they do come into contact with the dead through no fault of their own, the vow is immediately disallowed, right? And what has to happen is that they are rendered unclean, and after a period of purification, they can take the oath or make the vow again and start the process over. But coming into contact with the dead stops the process of the vow, and it has to be re-engaged after a period of time. It goes on at the end of this section in verse 13. When the period of their dedication is over, they are to be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, to the temple, or to the tabernacle. They are to present their offering to the Lord. And notice, they have to offer a year-old male lamb without defect for a burnt offering, a year-old ewe lamb without defect for a sin offering, a ram without defect for a fellowship offering. And again, it doesn't explain any of these details. We don't know why any of these details are connected to the taking or the making of a Nazirite vow. Of course, the details are explained in the oral Torah, but not in the written Torah. The written Torah just says what must be done. They bring these animals together with grain offerings and drink offerings and baskets of bread made with the finest flour and without yeast. The priest is to present all these items before the Lord. Then at the entrance to the tent of meeting, the Nazirite must shave off his hair that symbolizes their dedication, right? So they have let their hair grow long, they must shave their head, and then they can resume their normal life. Okay? So let's look at the passage in Acts 21 quickly. And notice on this occasion that Paul goes to Jerusalem. He meets with James and the elders in Jerusalem. They greet James and the elders. They greet Paul and his company very warmly. Paul shares with them what God has been doing among the Gentiles through them. And of course, James responds in verse 20. That's wonderful. They're all very excited about what the Lord is doing among the Gentiles. And then James mentions how many thousands of Jews there are who believe, and they are all zealous for the Torah, right? So it is a wonderful exchange of experiences and ideas. And then James makes the observation, you know, Paul, that it is said of you, that you tell all of the Jewish people who live among the Gentiles to turn away from the Torah, telling them not to circumcise their children or to live according to our customs. So what can we do to help people understand that this is not true. Okay? So, James suggests that Paul and those with him take a vow, right? Take these men who are prepared to make this vow with him, join in their purification rites, pay their expenses so that they can have their heads shaved. Then everyone will know that there is no truth in these reports about you, but that you yourself are living in obedience to the Torah. Okay? But of course, Paul says, I'm sorry, I can't take a vow like that, because I am not living in obedience to the Torah. Right? Is that what Paul says? No, of course not. What does he do? The next day, Paul took the men, purified himself along with them. He went to the temple to give notice of the date when the days of purification would end and the offering would be made for each of them, which is one of the attributes or characteristics associated with the taking of a Nazirite vow, but no others, right? In other words, everything that Paul does, from the shaving of the head at the end of the days when the vow is complete, right, to notifying the priests how long the vow will last, to everything else associated with this vow, it looks very much like a Nazirite vow. They took this oath for 7 days. When the 7 days were over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. And of course, you're familiar with what occurs when Paul is at the temple and all of the commotion that arises as a result of him being there. But nobody ever talks about what Paul was doing at the temple. What was he doing at the temple? He was offering the sacrifices that were required at the conclusion of the taking of a Nazirite vow. And in fact, he was not only offering sacrifices for himself, but for the men who took the vow with him. So this, as it turns out, was a very expensive vow, right? Because he has to offer these animals and offerings for himself. And, of course, he offers it for those who took the vow with him. And, of course, at the end of the process, right, they have their heads shaved. They're at the temple to offer the sacrifices. But, of course, it begs the question, if the death of Yeshua ended sacrifices, like many people think, then what is Paul doing at the temple offering a sacrifice? Not just a sacrifice, several sacrifices. Apparently, Paul never got the memo, right? Although, he is obviously among those whose writing is interpreted to mean that the Torah, and certainly these ritual procedures connected with the Torah, has been abolished, right? Obviously, that is not the way Paul lived his life. At any rate, this is a comment that I just kind of ran across at the bottom. There can be no doubt that the vow was that of the temporary Nazirite, which I agree with. It implied a separation from the world in common life. This was the meaning of the word Nazirite. And while under the vow, the man who had taken it was to drink no wine or strong drink, to let no razor pass over his head or face, obviously until the vow was completed. When the term was completed, he was to shave his head at the door of the tabernacle and burn the hair in the fire of the altar. It will be noted that the Nazirites in Acts 21, who are completing their vow, shave their heads, right? Here a different word, shorn, is used, which is contrasted with shaving in 1 Corinthians 11. It was lawful for a man to have his hair cut or crop during the continuance of the vow, and this apparently was what Paul did now. But in the case, in this case also, the hair so cut off was to be taken to the temple and burnt there, right? So the fact is, Paul had taken a Nazarite vow with all of the provisions that are connected to it. Why? Because he followed the Torah. He never taught against the Torah, never encouraged Jews who lived among the Gentiles in the diaspora to reject the Torah. He never discouraged anyone from being circumcised, because it's an important sign of the covenant between the Jewish people and God. And in Acts chapter 16, we see a passage in which it specifically talks about the fact that Paul has Timothy circumcised. Why? Because the text says that his mother was Jewish, making him Jewish, right? He wasn't circumcised because his father was a Greek. But Paul makes sure that this young Jewish man is circumcised. Obviously, it doesn't take place on the eighth day, but it takes place at a time when there is a recognition that he needs to be circumcised because he's part of the Jewish people and it connects him to the covenant with God. Okay? By the way, these other passages speak of many other things that Paul does in observance in the Torah as well. Like this passage in Acts 20. When Paul decides to sail past Ephesus on his way back to the land of Israel, he decides to sail past Ephesus. If you know anything about the gospel, the book of Acts, you know that Paul spent a lot of time in Ephesus. Why? Because there were congregations there that Paul was very connected to. He spends a whole year there on one visit alone, right? But in this case, he sails past Ephesus. Why? Because he doesn't want to spend time there. Why? Because he was in a hurry to reach Jerusalem by the day of Pentecost. Why should Paul be in a hurry to get to Jerusalem by the day of Pentecost? If you're familiar with the provision in the Torah, you know that all males were required to go to Jerusalem three times a year to observe the feasts. One of those holidays happens to be Pentecost, right? The Jewish people are supposed to go to Jerusalem for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for Pentecost, and for Shavuot. Here's a passage in which it says Paul deliberately sails past people that he has a very precious connection with in order to fulfill this provision in the Torah requiring his presence in Jerusalem for Pentecost, right? And don't forget that this is years after the events associated with Acts chapter 2. Okay? In Acts chapter 27, this is a passage which speaks about one of Paul's voyages. He's on the boat. They're making slow headway because of this wind, and the crew doesn't know what to do. Okay? And it makes an observation that much time had been lost in verse 9, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. Okay? The NIV refers to it as the Day of Atonement. Ironically, it is known as the Day of Atonement because of what the text actually says, which, when translated properly, should say because the fast was now already past. In the MacDonald idiomatic translation, because the Jewish fast day was already past. The New American Standard says since even the fast was already over, right? So there is a there is a recognition in the text, right, that the Moedim, the holidays, there was a recognition of the calendar and the way the calendar worked, right? And it's referred to as a fast day. And I would guess Paul, like all of the other Jews in his time, fasted on Yom Kippur, whether he was in Jerusalem or not, right? Which is something that the Jewish people still do to this day. Notice in Acts 17, it was Paul's custom on Shabbat to go to the synagogue, to be gathered together with his people, and on these occasions, because he was an itinerant rabbi traveling, and because people knew who he was offered an opportunity to share with the community regarding regarding an exposition of the scripture. In Acts 23, Paul refers to himself as a Pharisee. He does not say, "I was a Pharisee." He says, "I am a Pharisee," right? So even after his experience with Yeshua, even after his change of heart, his heart changed, not his practices, right? In other words, he didn't stop being a Pharisee. He didn't reject the teaching or the instruction of the rabbis in the yeshivot he attended, right? They had all those concepts and ideas had been integrated into his heart. And he refers to the fact that he's descended from Pharisees as well. And he actually talks about the fact that he says that he's on trial because of what he, like all other Pharisees, believed about the resurrection. Notice in Acts 24, prior to his appealing to Caesar, he's arrested on the Temple Mount, you remember earlier in Acts chapter 21, and he goes through a series of trials. In one of these trials, he mentions that his accusers did not find him arguing with anyone in the temple. They did not find him stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. They cannot prove that the charges against him are true. And he does admit in verse 14 that he is, "I do worship the God of our ancestors as a follower of the way," right? Not in contradistinction to the followers of the way. Paul did not see anything about his faith in his trusting Yeshua. Paul didn't see anything in trusting Yeshua that flew in the face of the way Jews worship God, right? There was nothing inconsistent with the faith of those who were followers of the way and their faith as Jews, which, of course, notice in this passage in verse 14, was regarded as a sect of Judaism at the time. Not Christianity, not a separate faith. The followers of the way were regarded as a sect of Judaism. Okay? But notice what Paul goes on to say in verse 14. "I believe everything that is in accordance with the Torah and that is written in the prophets. And I have the same hope in God as these men themselves have, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked." By the way, in verse 18 of this passage, he says that he was ceremonially clean when people found him in the temple courts, which means that he went through the waters of one of the mikvahs that surrounded the temple precinct, right? When you go up to the temple to worship God, into the temple courtyard, you have to go through a mikveh, which Paul does here as well. Which means, by definition, that a mikveh, or going through a baptism, is not a one-time event. Right? Jews went through a mikveh every single time, including Yeshua, every single time they went up to the Temple Mount to worship God. Right? Paul says that that is what he did too. He was ceremonially clean when people found him on the Temple Mount. So people couldn't even use that as an accusation against him. In Acts 25, he says, I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law or against the temple. In Acts 28, he goes on, and this is when he's speaking to the elders or the leadership of the community in Rome. I have done nothing against our people or against the customs of our ancestors. And if you look in your notes, you'll see that this word for customs is different than the word which is used of handed down teaching. In other words, Paul not only defends himself against a violation of the teaching of the fathers, which would have been the oral tradition, but here he says he hasn't even done anything against the customs, the minchagim, right? The practices which over time take upon themselves the character of religious law. Paul says he hasn't even acted against the customs of our people, right? So not only was Paul faithful to the written Torah, he was faithful to the oral Torah, and he was faithful to the minchagim as well. And by the way, this is not an opinion. Right? This is what Paul himself testifies to in these documents, right? So it makes you wonder, doesn't it, whether all of those passages in which Paul writes about doing away with the Torah, no longer being obligated to Torah, no longer being obligated to some of the ritual aspects of Judaism, the necessity of no longer having to celebrate the holidays. I mean, obviously, Paul's writing cannot be understood that way, regardless of the way it sounds, right? Given Paul's life and what he testifies to. At any rate, you can look at those other passages in this section on your own too, if you would. But I want to move back to the essay because there are still some important things to discuss. If this analysis is correct, then a single theme binds the laws and narrative of this portion. The theme of making special efforts to preserve or restore peace between people, right? And remember, peace between people is not the absence of strife. It's a genuine connection between people, right? That's what true peace means, and that's what we strive to experience. Peace is easily damaged and hard to repair. Much of the rest of the book of Numbers is a set of variations on the theme of internal dissension and strife. So has Jewish history been as a whole. The fact that these laws are stated before the narratives of conflict that dominate many of the later chapters of Numbers is an instance of the principle that God creates the cure before the disease. Parashat Naso tells us that we have to go the extra mile in bringing peace between husband and wife, between leaders of the community, among lay people who aspire to a more than usual state of sanctity. We have to make sure that all the tribes who participate in a ceremony such as the inauguration of the tabernacle get equal attention, even if it means repeating the description 12 times. Shalom has such a rich meaning in Hebrew, harmony between conflicting elements, each of which has its distinctive part to play in the integrated diversity of the whole. Thus, the laws that illustrate the pursuit of peace are clustered together at the beginning of Numbers, the book that more than any other in the Torah documents the conflicts and self-inflicted injuries of the Israelites in the wilderness. The solution is not strong government, central control, and the imposition of uniformity. To the contrary, it is valuing diversity as a way to achieve shlemut, wholeness, perfection, and thus shalom as a calibrated harmony between the various elements, each with its role and each with its place. It is no accident that the priestly blessings end, as do the vast majority of Jewish prayers, with a prayer for peace. Peace, said the rabbis, is one of the names of God Himself, and Maimonides writes that the whole Torah was given to make peace in the world. Parashat Naso is a series of practical lessons in how to ensure, as far as possible, that everyone feels recognized and respected, and that suspicion is diffused and dissolved. We have to work for peace, not just pray for it. By the way, as we continue, I saved some of my comments for the end, because I didn't want to interrupt the flow of the essay any more than I already had with the lengthy discussion regarding the Nazarite vow. But the blessing at the in Numbers chapter 6 is mentioned here as well. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons," on the last page of the notes, "this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn His face towards you and anoint you," or give you, "peace. So will they put My name on the Israelites, and I will bless them." What follows is a series of passages that speak of peace and the way the word shalom is used in a variety of different contexts. Like in this passage in Numbers 25, when Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, turned God's anger away from the Israelites, God told him that He was making with him a covenant of peace. Notice this covenant of peace was a covenant of a lasting peace priesthood. But of course, they are not two different things, right? They are one thing. They are synonyms. These are parallel expressions or phrases for the same thing, that God was anointing him or making with him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, which is referred to as a covenant of peace, right? Because through him, the integrity or the wholeness of the community was restored. Notice this passage in Psalm 119. "Great peace have they who," what? "Who love God's Torah, and nothing can make them stumble," right? And then in the next verse it goes on to say, "I wait for your salvation, O Lord, and I follow your commands. I obey your statutes, for I love them greatly." And of course, this is one of the Psalms that speaks of Torah being expressed, being observed, because of the great love we have for God, right? Not to save us, because no one is saved through Torah observance. Salvation is a gift, right? Not something which can be merited. But because it can't be merited, doesn't mean that we as God's children don't have a responsibility to walk in God's ways, right? But it's a function of the love that we have for God. That's why we observe these things. In Psalm 122, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, right? Because you, as you know, Jerusalem is also a city which is often characterized by conflict. And so we pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Not just that there would be an absence of strife, but that the people of Jerusalem, right, would be able to be connected together in such a way so as to recognize the diversity that exists within it. In Proverbs 14, a heart at peace gives life to the body. Envy rots the bones. This is antithetical parallelism. Two statements that say opposite things. They say the same thing, but expressing it as opposites. Notice finally in Romans 8, the mind governed by the flesh is death, the mind governed by the spirit is life and peace. Right? So, based upon what it says in Psalm 119, you could also say the mind governed by the Spirit is a mind governed by those who love the Torah, right? Because the word peace is associated with both, with loving God and loving Torah. The mind governed by the flesh is hostile to God. Right? And notice, it does not submit to God's law. So, if the mind governed by the flesh is lawless, then the mind governed by the Spirit must be, by definition, lawful. Right? Does that mean it's observed perfectly? No, of course not. No one observes it perfectly. But it means that the mind governed by the Spirit, or the heart governed by the Spirit, has a heart for God's law. And finally, in Hebrews chapter 12, you're familiar with this passage, no doubt. Make every effort to live in peace with everyone. Right? So, of course, in Hebrew, that does not mean make every effort to avoid strife in your relationships with people. It means make every effort to facilitate connections between people, right? Bring something positive to the connection between people, right? Not just be satisfied because at the moment nobody is hurting someone else, right? That's not enough. It's not enough to avoid strife. It's not enough to assume, you know, because none of the people I'm trying to avoid have said anything nasty to me lately, that everything's okay. Do you understand? That isn't peace. That might be the way peace works in English, but certainly not in Hebrew. Make every effort to live in peace with everyone and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. Okay. I'm going to stop here. I regret having to skip the parts that we did, but I can see by the time that it's a good thing that we did, otherwise, you know, we would still be going for another 10 minutes or so, probably. So I encourage you to read those sections that we kind of skipped over on your own. But I'm going to look at the chats and to see if there's anything that we can discuss. Lindy made a comment regarding my the fact that I mentioned that I have not taken a Nazirite vow. My long hair is not the result of taking a Nazirite vow, although I have been asked that question from time to time. But Lindy makes the observation, therefore, because I have not taken a Nazirite vow, I enjoy a glass of wine on Shabbat, right? But of course, not the sweet Manischewitz wine, but real wine. Wine that I refer to as real wine, in my case. Also from Lindy, what happened with Paul and the crowds, the rampage on the Temple Mount is similar to the nonsense rampage that is happening here. And she's not obviously referring to the protesting, but to the looting, right? From Mark, some of my friends say we just need to pray for peace. I like that you mentioned both prayer and action. We have a part, and God has a part in what I am hearing. James said that faith without works is unproductive, and I agree completely, right? That's the way Rabbi Sacks ends the essay, right? In other words, he says that we have to work for peace, not just to pray for it. So that is absolutely true. And as hard as this is to hear, we should act when injustice takes place, right? We should act on the behalf of what is right when we see something inappropriate taking place, right? It's not enough to stand back and do or say nothing, right? We have to do or say something, because that's the only way that things are going to change, right? Okay, so that's the end of the chats. Any other comments or observations about today's study?
When Paul said shorn, used the word shorn.
Yes.
They would do what they shear or a shorn sheep.
That's correct.
It would mean that it would be, I guess for the lack of another description, would it be like shaving it bald would be shorn? Yes? No?
No.
It's the same word, so I just wondered.
No, it's a different word. Shaving and shorning are two different things.
Right, but he used the word shorn.
Right, so it means to shave. It means to shave or to cut the hair close to the head, but not to shave it bald. Okay, David, yes, go ahead.
Just a comment about the Nazirite vow. I heard Rabbi Hyman Richmond say, this kind of makes sense, this is more of a comment than anything else, that if you take a Nazirite vow today, but that vow would have to be for the rest of your life because the requirements that are demanded at the end of the vow, the mechanism is no longer there to do that. Nazirite vow today, but
that's an interesting observation. I frankly would need to I'd have to give that some thought before I just kind of, yes, that makes a lot of sense. But the reason why I say that is because there are various offerings and animals that are required to be slaughtered at various holidays, right? But because there is no temple, that requirement has been temporarily set aside as well, right? In other words, sacrifices are required at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at Passover, at Shavuot, at Yom Kippur, at Sukkot, But we don't offer those sacrifices, not because they're not required in the Bible, and not because God has done away with sacrifices, but because there isn't a temple. So the requirement to offer those animals has temporarily been set aside. And I would guess, I'd like to think about it some more, but I would guess that some explanation could be put forward to alleviate the need for the animal sacrifices associated with the Nazirite vow, with the end of the Nazirite vow as well, because it's no longer possible to offer them, right? But for what it's worth, that would be an immediate observation. Very good. Yes.
Because the temple isn't there, and because there's no sacrifices, the rabbis instituted more prayers and donations to take the place of the sacrifices. So would that also perhaps apply to the Nazirite?
One of the problems with, forgive me, but one of the problems with the statement, it is often said that when the sacrifices stopped, right, that prayer was implemented as a replacement for sacrifice. But the fact of the matter is prayer has always been associated with the sacrifices, right? So the fact of the matter is that when we bring a sacrifice to the Lord, there are certain things that are connected to the offering of the sacrifice: confession, prayer, a contribution is made. So the things that can no longer be done are not done, like the sacrifice itself, but the other things which go with it, the prayer, the confession, the contribution, those things take a larger role in the process, right? But it's not like they were substituted for it.
I stand corrected.
Well,
but it seems to me what they did was they had more of what was in order, so that we can't do the sacrifices as yet. Although, when the temple is, probably not in our lifetime, is back.
We'll see.
Continue to do what we're doing, and then perhaps bring the sacrifice.
Yep, very good. By the way, let me just make a comment. I'm a teacher, right? In Jewish thought, a teacher, in biblical times, a teacher was referred to as a rabbi, and of course that is the case today. And I was ordained as a messianic rabbi years and years ago, right? But when I went through a divorce, that ordination was revoked. I was ordained again by another organization that required that it be re-affected annually. And years ago, when I stopped being involved in the Messianic movement, I let that go as well. So, I appreciate the expression of respect, but it's okay just to refer to me as Bob, right? It is not important to me that you refer to me with a title, as much as I appreciate it. The fact of the matter is, I'm just a teacher, right? So, the Hebrew word for teacher is moré, right? I am a moré. Of course, in biblical times, Yeshua, who was also referred to as a rabbi, and all of the other rabbis that existed in the first century, they were not ordained as rabbis either, because the official ordination of rabbis doesn't take place until the second century, right? So, It's obviously a designation which is in use today, but it is not necessary. Okay? Thank you, Ed. I appreciate your comment. Ed, I very much appreciate your comment, but hopefully it helps us to appreciate just how relevant the Torah is to our lives on the one hand, and how important it is to implement these ideas in terms of what they truly represent in our lives, right? I mean, the fact is, we often express with a good deal of hope that the people of this world will live in peace when the Messiah comes, right? And I think that's an expectation that we all share, that when the Messiah comes, he will right the wrongs that exist in each and every culture on the planet. But the fact of the matter is like Ed mentioned and like Mark mentioned, the fact of the matter is that we have to work towards it now, right? We can't wait for the Messiah to come, frankly. We can't wait for the Messiah to come. You know, Shelley often mentions to me, you know, wouldn't it be nice when the Messiah comes, for him to find people who are faithful to him on this earth, right? But being faithful to God, in some ways, means not tolerating injustice, right? And doing something about it if we see it, if we experience it, right? I'm not suggesting that's easy to do. All I'm saying is that is a part of our obligation and responsibility as God's people, right? Whatever that means and however that works in your life where you live. But the fact of the matter is that we have to do more, right? Okay, David, sorry.
What I understand or hear a lot from other rabbis is that we have, you know, the whole purpose of Tikkun Olam, you know, to fix the world. And we have to merit through the actions of our lives, we have to merit the return of the Messiah. And I know that you know, maybe not a teaching you can get directly from the Brit Hadashah, so to speak, or the New Testament, but you know, but what's your opinion on that?
Good question. There are rabbis who do teach that, although the word merit doesn't really mean in Hebrew what it means in English, right? In other words, in English, it sounds like the Jewish people must deserve the return of the Messiah. Because that's what the word merit means in English. But that is not what it means in Hebrew. Okay? So, those rabbis are not teaching that the Jewish people have to be in such a place just before the Messiah comes that we deserve it as a reward for our good and decent behavior. Okay? I can mention two observations, two things. The first has to do with what Yeshua mentions in the Gospels when he speaks about his coming. He says that he, as the Messiah, will return to earth when the Jewish people cry out, "Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord." Right? Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. It's a messianic exclamation, and it's connected with the return of the Messiah, not only in the Bible, but in the rabbinic literature as well. And it speaks of an occasion when the Jewish people cry out to God for him to come back. Okay? Oftentimes, that expression regarding crying out to God comes at a time when the circumstances of our lives are not ideal, right? And that's expressed in a variety of different ways, like, I don't know if you remember the movie Fiddler on the Roof, but it's one of the comments that Tevye makes when the people of Anatevka are moving to yet another village, right? Somebody makes the observation, Rabbi, wouldn't it be a good time for the Messiah to come now? Right? And of course, the answer is, it's always a good time for the Messiah to come, right? So, yes, it would be great if the Messiah came this afternoon before we, you know, say, Shalom Lehitra Ot, I'll see you the next time, right? But it's always a good time. Another observation is a story in the Talmud. There's a story about someone who speaks with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai about the coming of the Messiah. And in this vision, or this experience that they are having together, Ben Zakkai mentions, in the distance, he sees the Messiah sitting, and he tells the person who asks him the question, he says, there's the Messiah, why don't you go over and ask him? Okay? So, the guy does, he walks over, and he asks the Messiah when he is coming, and the Messiah responds, today. Okay? So, the guy comes back, and he's very excited. The Messiah said he's coming today, right? The problem, of course, is that the Messiah, when he responds with the one word today, is not saying today. He's responding with a quote from Psalm 95. It's a remez to Psalm 95. And he uses it in the exact same way that the author of Hebrews does, when the author of Hebrews quotes the same passage and says, today, if you hear my voice, right? In other words, the conclusion of the story in terms of what is said about it in the text, if the Jewish people are ready for the Messiah when he will come as David, riding on the clouds with great glory. And if the Jewish people are not ready for the Messiah when he comes, he will come lowly, riding a colt, and he will be punished on the behalf of the people. Right? So, that's the way the issue is resolved. We don't know. It depends on the condition of God's people when they come. But being ready doesn't mean being so good that you deserve his presence. It means having a heart which is open to receive him. Okay? Go ahead. David, another comment?
Well, I was just saying, was the comment or the observation you made, was that from rabbinic literature, or was that a story in the Talmud?
Yeah, the Talmud is rabbinic literature.
Right. So the comparison of the Messiah coming as Messiah ben David, or coming as on a white horse, or on the colt that you described, is that a story that you can extract also from rabbinic literature?
Well, that story takes place in the Talmud. It's from the rabbinic literature. The Talmud is rabbinic literature. This particular story comes from the tractate in the Talmud called Sanhedrin on the laws regarding the way the Sanhedrin operate. But of course, it's based upon the Torah. It's based upon passages in the Torah, like the passage in Zechariah, which speak of the Messiah coming lowly, riding upon the donkey, and and other passages which speak of the Messiah's death and suffering. And of course, there are passages in the rabbinic literature and in the Bible that speak of the Messiah coming to reign in glory. And it has to do with the fact that that by the first century, the rabbis had not really, and frankly into the 5th and 6th centuries, the rabbis had really not resolved this issue regarding the way the Messiah comes. And so, it's like when we are praying about something and things don't work out like we think they should or hope, you know, we kind of resign ourselves to trusting that God will accomplish His will in our lives, whatever that might be, right? It's the same idea. The rabbis leave the coming of the Messiah to the discretion of God. That it's really up to God when the Messiah comes. Right? So. Okay, let me move on to another comment. There is a few other... thank you, David. There's a few other chats. Charlene, thank you for the lesson. But you will always be rabbi to me. Thank you. From Elmer and to me too. Thank you. Thank you. From Wanda, I often wondered why God had to command us to love one another. This last week it has really opened up my eyes with the command, why the command was necessary. Love of one another is work. And we have to work at respecting each other and appreciate the gift God has given us of loving others. Absolutely, I agree. And appreciate the comment from Lindy, so right, well said. From Jane, Shavuot Tov, have a blessed week. Thank you. From Jennifer, Isaiah speaks of the Messiah as the Prince of Peace. We are to be like him. That's another passage, by the way. The Prince of Peace is one who brings peace. He facilitates peace. He facilitates connection and restoration, right? We are to be like him, so we should all be peacemakers. Amen. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Right, so peacemakers. So being a child of God, it kind of comes with an obligation, a responsibility to be a peacemaker, right? Not just a peace prayer for, right? But a peacemaker, a peace facilitator. Of course, praying for peace is important too, but praying for peace and working towards peace are the same thing, right? At least in Jewish thought, they would be considered the same thing. You know, of course, that the Hebrew word for work, avodah, means worship in Hebrew. The Hebrew word for work and worship are the same word. So to work on God's behalf and to worship God mean the same thing. Okay, any other comments? Thank you for everyone. Thank you so far. Any other comments? We have, as far as I'm concerned, we have time for more discussion.
I have a comment.
Okay.
And see if you can give me some clarity on this. When you just expressed that, you know, the word for work in Hebrew means worship, then why all the conflict about works of righteousness?
Oh, that's, well, the conflict, the conflicts regarding works and faith is a conflict that was invented by Martin Luther in the 16th century, right? Because of the emphasis that Martin Luther put on the faith that Christians are required to have in order to be saved, right? He, along with many of the other church leaders, beginning in the second century, used that concept of faith alone as another way to emphasize or to communicate the dichotomy between Christianity and Judaism. So he's the one who invented the notion that Jews are saved by works and Christians are saved by faith, right? Even though that dichotomy does not exist in the Bible, right? So the word avodah means work, service, worship, right? But it's a way of worshiping God. And we worship God because we adore Him, because we love Him. In other words, we don't worship God in order to be saved. We worship God because He has saved. Right? It's so important to understand it.
And that's such an almost, what do you call it, cognitive dissonance sort of thing when, you think about, I've heard, again, I listen to a lot of rabbinical teachings, and every rabbi I've spoken to, or not spoken to, but listened to with regards to, salvation or God's grace or anything like that, have openly stated, we don't observe the Torah to earn our salvation. We observe the Torah out of gratitude for what God has done for us.
That's correct. And the reason why that is so frequently asserted is because the Torah was given to God's people after they were redeemed from Egypt, not before.
Right.
So, the Torah was given to a redeemed people. Right?
Not only that,
right.
They didn't keep the law, or the covenant, not the covenant, the law, before they were physically, they were told it, and before they were physically given it, they broke it. And God, and Moses smashed what he was bringing to them, have it all back.
This is one of the great ironies in the Bible. By the way, have any of you, we've talked about this, but not for a long time. Sometimes the question comes up, how long were Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden before they were expelled, right? As it turns out, Adam and Eve were created on the afternoon of the sixth day of creation, right? Before Shabbat. Depending upon, who you talk to or what rabbi you listen to, the fact of the matter is that Adam and Eve were actually in the garden for a notoriously short time before they sinned, right? And what's remarkable is what Lindy just mentioned regarding the Torah. Moses goes up to the mountain. He's up there for 40 days, right? He doesn't even get to bring the Torah to the people, right? He throws the tablets onto the ground on his way down as soon as he reaches them, right? So they never receive the Torah, that first set of tablets, before it's broken, right? But something that we read today, God creates the cure before the problem even exists, right? And that's the way it was for Adam and Eve. That's the way it was for God's people. And frankly, that's the way it is for you too. Right? Why? Because God is gracious. That's why. Because God is gracious. He He loves you. You have intrinsic value to him. Right? And it doesn't make any difference what color you are, what you believe, what you do. We all have intrinsic value to God because we are created in his image. If nothing else, you would think that understanding that we are all created in the image of God would help us to appreciate just how remarkable God is. You know, the diversity that even exists in God, in the character of God, right? God is a lot bigger than we think. And we should live our lives with a recognition that that is true, to appreciate each other, right? At any rate, it's a remarkable phenomenon that God recognizes what we're like long before we do, and created us anyway, right? Loves us anyway. Sometimes we are obviously more lovable than we are at other times, but that doesn't change it. God's love is without conditions. From Lindy, we have so much to learn from each other and all our diversities. A richer life. Oops.
We would just have so much a richer life if we would all stop and be willing to learn and spend time learning about each other.
I agree.
And giving each other the ability to be who we are and still learn from each other. We don't have to change each other. We just have to learn to be with each other and learn about each other's differences and become a richer person in the process.
Yeah, and by the way, change is a good thing. But the objective of change is not for you to become like me, but for you to become more like God. And that should be my change objective as well, right?
I'm going to throw something out here because I'm a part of a group that this guy, I sent it to Bob, but I just listened to an incredible study by a rabbi in Israel who is, forget his last name, but his first name is Menachem. And he starts it by saying he made Aliyah to Israel from, ready, the Mea Shearim. He was a Haredi Jew. But what he has created, and the long and short of it is, he has created schools not to take to the Haredim in Israel to help them learn some secular information and yet still not have them leave the belief system of the Haredim. It's a very, and it's not an easy situation, but he has created these schools and they are thriving and he is doing that. So he's not asking them to leave their important beliefs, but he's asking them to open their minds to their society that's right next door. And And there's an amazing video that went viral a number of years ago about what he did on Jerusalem's Memorial Day because the Haredim do not acknowledge it.
And right. The Haredi Jews are ultra-Orthodox Jews. The most of the ultra-Orthodox Jews do not recognize the authority of the State of Israel. Yes. Because the Messiah is not the one who has established it. So, they are looking forward to the coming of the Messiah, and when the Messiah comes, Israel will be reconstituted as a nation, and so some do not recognize the validity of the existing state. It's kind of an odd irony. But They often, in their education, their education emphasizes Torah and Hebrew, of course, but no secular subjects. We have discussed this in the Pirkei Avot study, because this is something that we have talked about, because even in biblical times, there were rabbis who restricted their teaching and education to biblical subjects, and others who showed interest in philosophy, mathematics, science, other studies as well. Gematria. At any rate, very good. Any other comments? I'm looking for other chats. From Wanda, great lesson, thank you. And from Lindy, good study. Sometimes life can be very confusing. From Charlene, I agree. Sometimes life can be very confusing. I'm inclined to say that's an understatement, but I think you intended it that way, right? Agreed.
Oh, Bob?
Yeah.
I think I remember my comment now, and this will probably really put my scriptural ignorance on display, but so be it. When I was reading through the portion today, and they were talking about all the livestock, all the animals that they had to bring from each of the tribal chiefs, how many different animals that they brought, and how much grain that they had to bring, and you know, we get, or at least I had sort of had an epiphany. That we know when you think of the Israel as wandering in the wilderness, you have a tendency to think of it that they were in the middle of Death Valley or something like that. But you know, in order to bring those animals, they had to have live in a place or be in a place where the animals had enough vegetation to eat and sustain themselves, enough water to sustain themselves, enough land to grow the grain. So. So it wasn't like that they were, at that point, do you think that the manna that was still being produced was more symbolic of just God's presence and provision? Because, you know, they had those things available to them, and it wasn't until they actually went over into the promised land that the manna stopped. But weren't there some tribes have decided that we're not going to cross over because we like it here.
Right, but that even the tribes that didn't cross over into the promised land itself, they still lived in an area which is opposite the promised land, on the east bank of the Jordan River as opposed to the west side. So the fact is that they still journeyed through the wilderness together. The 12 tribes journeyed through the wilderness together. Unfortunately, we do not know how many people actually travel through the wilderness. We do not know the size of their herds and flocks. Based upon the census, we know that there were 600,000 men that were capable of going to war, who were between the ages of 30 and 60. So, there have been many people speculate regarding the number, but even a conservative estimate, if you assume that most of the men were married and that they had children, which is probably safe to assume in most cases, there would have been 2 to 3 million of them, right? But, of course, the wilderness, the word desert in Hebrew, it can mean a Death Valley kind of desert, but that kind of desert doesn't exist in Israel. It doesn't exist anywhere along the way from Egypt to the Promised Land. So it's best not to think of the wilderness as a Death Valley kind of desert. It's not that void of vegetation. It's not that void of animal life. It's not that void. It's not a wasteland like that. And there are no descriptions in the Bible as to how the people were sustained by God, and you can assume the animals as well. We know that God provided manna, which was something that they ate. God provided water, right? And a very telling statement, there is a statement in the Torah which says that the sandals of the people did not wear out, even though they wore that same pair of sandals for the entire 40 years, right? So, I think it's safe to assume on some level that God made it possible so that other things didn't wear out too, right? Not just sandals, not just clothing. It's possible to apply it to some of the provisions they had. Lindy makes a comment that they complained they had no meat, right? But the complaint probably had little to do with meat. The complaint had to do with being in a bad place spiritually before God, right? It had to do with coming to terms with what God wanted to accomplish in the lives of His people. They obviously complain that they have no water. They complain that they have no meat, which God provides. God provides both meat and water. But you probably are all aware of the fact that did not change the character of the complaints, of subsequent complaints, right? They complain they have no water. God gives them water. Does the complaining stop? No. They complain they have no meat. God gives them meat. Did the complaining stop? No. Right? I mean, Korah complains that Moses isn't the one who should really be leading them. God provides an ample presentation of the fact that Moses is or was the one raised up by God to lead them. Does that stop the complaining? No. I mean, complaining is a condition of the heart. It has absolutely nothing to do with what you have or don't have. Right? Complaining is a condition of a heart inclined not to appreciate the things that God has given us. Right? It's a lack of gratitude. Whatever the source of that is, it's a lack of gratitude. By the way, Wayne mentions it's been nice spending this time with everyone. I agree. It's always a blessing to spend this time together. Any other comments before we go?
Bob, it's Roderick.
Yes.
Earlier this week, I heard a comment from Rabbi David Foreman, who pointed out that in the English translation of the text, it said that Israel, when they came to the waters of Marah, but they couldn't drink it, for it was bitter. And he comments that the word translated in English for it could just have easily been translated they.
Correct.
They could not drink the waters, for they were bitter. Which, it's not necessarily to suggest that the waters themselves were not in fact bitter and needed to be cleansed, but it opens up the conversation to understand that oftentimes when the blessing has been apportioned, bitterness keeps us from recognizing that blessing or recognizing the goodness or even recognizing the sufficiency of what God has apportioned. And on the heels of that, Israel, or many in Israel, were saying, we want to go back to Egypt. And there's a list of foods that they say that they're missing. And I found that particular list really interesting because, as you know, in the work that I do, I understand trauma and its impact biologically and physiologically on the body. And we know that one of the things that happens from undue stress or toxic stress or trauma, it will inhibit your taste buds. And it inhibits the flow of insulin. So the body gets a sense of craving sugar, which is exactly what melons do. That melons provide you with a sweetness and a sugar, and that's one of the things on the list that they're asking for. And trauma and toxic stress can dull the taste buds, and it makes some people who like having flavor in their food, they will actually, this is actually a symptom of trauma or toxic stress, is when people over flavor their food because they're trying to taste what otherwise they would be able to taste with an appropriate amount of seasoning. They overdo it in order to evoke some kind of flavor, such as leeks and onions and garlic, which are all very pungent, strong tastes. And in a sense, we get clues from the text. It's not just that they want to go back to Egypt because they think it was so good back there, but that's what they know. I mean, we're all drawn to what we know, and what they knew was when we were in Egypt, we could eat food and we could enjoy the flavor, or at least that's what their memory was telling them. And here they are at the waters of an oasis, and they can't even drink or appreciate the provision because they're full of bitterness. And that bitterness is fueled by the complaints, by an unwillingness to be content. I mean, I'm sorry, at this moment I don't remember if it was David or his son Solomon that wrote that contentment with godliness is great gain.
Yeah.
And I see this also reflected in this week's portion and in the lesson that you brought us today, Bob, that the real sense of shalom is not the absence of that conflict or the absence of that toxic stress or trauma, but rather it's an integration of diversity. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with George Orwell, the fiction writer who wrote one of his books called Animal Farm.
And, come on, everybody read Animal Farm in high school.
Yes, and you know, it starts off that all pigs are equal. But then eventually, you know, some pigs are more equal than other pigs. And it's like the reason why so much of our conflicts are existing and we're experiencing these riots is because individuals are afraid of what's different and what's not like them. And we read things like we're created in the image of God, that we're all created in his image according to his likeness, but at the end of the day, some people say, well, some of us are more in the image of God than others because they're afraid of that diversity. And so that's some things I've been reflecting on the last little while.
Yeah, good observation. Thank you. It is one of the things, Roderick's comment does, it is one of the important things about Hebrew and how flexible the language is and how easy it is to draw applications from the text, midrash, from the text, right? That the people couldn't eat or drink of that water because they were bitter, not because it was bitter, right? So it's one of the texts that provides for an insight into the human condition, right? So that's a good observation. Good. Thank you for the insight. Any other comments before we go?
I'm still going to call you Rabbi too.
How about a good week coming? How about a safe week? How about one less?
Amen. A week in which we see real change take place in our country. Wouldn't that be nice?
Really caring for another, not just words.
Yeah. Anyone else? So I guess if there aren't any other comments, I guess we'll call it a day. So may the Lord be with you and keep you and please pray for peace, not just the peace of Jerusalem, but for the peace of our communities as well. And of course that does not just mean the absence of strife, but a true appreciation for the diversity that exists in our culture and the realization that we are all created in the image of God. So I pray that the Lord would bless you with whatever is left of your Shabbat or with a wonderful week. I see Jane had to go, but she expressed a Shavuot Tov, a wonderful week. So may the Lord be with you and keep you, and Lord willing, I will see you on Thursday night, but if not, next Shabbat, okay? God bless you guys. May the Lord touch you and be with you and keep you. Stay safe, because we're also dealing with the coronavirus as well. That hasn't gone anywhere either, right?
So, I don't even hear about it anymore.
Don't hear about it as much, but unfortunately, in some places, as restrictions are relaxed, the number of cases goes up, right? Which is what you would expect. So we have to stay on top of that as well. So God bless you guys. May the Lord be with you.
Be well, Rabbi.
Thank you. You too. God bless.